You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. The Beatles are not only the greatest rock group of all time, but they are by far the most written about rock group of all time. On this show, we've tried to cover the best and most important books on the Beatles. And today, David Bedford is my guest. He is a journalist and rock historian, and along with Gary Popper, he has written one of the most fascinating books about the early history of the Beatles. The book is called Finding the Fourth Beatle, the untold story of 23 drummers who put the beat in the Beatles. David Bedford, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So this book shouldn't be anybody's first Beatle book. They should have read maybe a Beatle biography or two. I guess there's levels of fanship, you know. But I think most people think, you know, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. And then there's a second level of fan who know there was a Pete Best. But I don't think anybody knows anything about 23 guys.
Well, to be fair, when I started on this project, my first book, which was a nice entry-level one, Liddypool, Birthplace of the Beatles, is just a book about the Beatles in Liverpool. So that's really popular, particularly with people visiting here. The second book was called The Fab 104, and I've got 104 people involved in the evolution of the Beatles from the start going through to the end of 1962. Now, I uncovered all kinds of names and people who played in groups which nobody had heard of before. And this is where my friend Gary Popper comes into the story. I was working with him on a documentary film called Looking for Lennon, which has just come out. But he said, you know, with your Fab 104 book, I hadn't realised that they'd had so many drummers in the early years. And in that second book, I'd uncovered the fact that they had 12 drummers up to the end of 1962. So he said, wouldn't it be good to just do the book about the drummers? I said, yeah, great idea, let's do that. He said, we can call it 12 Drummers Drumming. We thought, that would be perfect. And it was until I found a 13th drummer. And then it went to 15, then to 80, and I kept finding more and more. Because nobody has gone down this route of tracking all the way through the story, all the different drummers. And the more you look at it, the more you realise that all the crises that they had in the group, even from near the beginning, always tended to revolve around a drummer. Whether they were losing one, whether they're trying to gain one, fighting with some, and trying to find the perfect one. And so we thought, yeah, let's tell the story of the drummers. And in doing that, we sort of tell the story of the group from the Quarrymen in 56 when they started, right up until the Beatles broke up in 1970.
And, of course, we know that Ringo was the drummer for 8 years and Pete Best was the drummer for 2 years. Who had the shortest and longest other than those two?
Oh, very good question. The criteria to make it into the book was you had to have played with the group in any guise from the Quarrymen right through to the Fab Four. You must have either played on stage with them, played in a studio with them, made a record with them. So it's not just jamming around and messing around. It had to be something specific. So that there's a few of them who just played the once. The shortest is a guy who only played for one song. Now, this was back in June 1960, and they were still called the Silver Beatles then. And they just had a problem with their drummer. Tommy Moore was the drummer they'd had. And the Silver Beatles had done this little tour around Scotland for a couple of weeks. And Tommy Moore and John Lennon just didn't get on. When they got back to Liverpool, Tommy said, that's it, I've had enough, I'm quitting. And he walked out. So they turned up at a place called the Grosvenor Ballroom on the other side of the River Mersey from Liverpool. And they've got the drum kit there, but no drummer. So John tries to make a joke, you know, is there a drummer in the house? Well, first of all, a 16-year-old lad got up and he said, I think I could do that. He played one song with them and he said, I'm terrible, and he walked off again. Funnily enough, this guy then became the leader of one of the best Merseybeat groups, and as a solo singer, recorded for Apple produced by George Harrison, and that's a guy called Jackie Lomax.
Sour Milk Sea.
Sour Milk Sea, yeah. As a 16-year-old kid in Wallasey, he actually got up and he played one song on the drums with the Silver Beatles, and he said that was terrible, and I just walked off again. So he had the shortest time, just one song. And so he'd gone like about 5 minutes. On the other side, really, you've got, as you say, Ringo from 63 through till 70. Then you got Pete Best for his 2 years. And Colin Hampton from the Quarrymen, the very first drummer in John's first group. Well, he was there from the end of 1956 until the beginning of sort of that March time, 1959.
So he played for longer than Pete Best did.
Yeah. Yeah. But of course, they didn't do as many performances back then. And of course, if you wanted to count live hours, well, I think Pete played more hours live with the Beatles than Ringo did.
Right, because
in Hamburg, they're playing 6-8 hours a night.
And a Beatles concert was 35 minutes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah.
Well, it's really an interesting book, and it's very amusing. But, you know, one of the things that comes up again and again from the 23 people who played drums is, you know, oh, he could have been the fourth Beatle, or that he might have been, you know, I mean, especially with Pete Best, well, he might have been the guy who became a millionaire. But do you think that the alchemy that really made it work is that Ringo was there? I mean, do you think they would have been as successful a band and had, you know, this incredible run if it hadn't been Ringo?
You know, it's one of those funny things, because I'm originally from the Dingle. I grew up just by where Ringo was born. I went to the elementary primary school that Ringo had gone to. So he's always sort of been a favourite of mine, anyway. But he's always been sort of the clown, you know, the jokey one, the funny guy. And because I'm not a drummer, and as you'll know from the book, you know, to analyse a drummer, I went out and I sought as many drummers as I could to understand, was Ringo just a lucky guy? Was he just in the right place at the right time? Or did he really contribute something significant? Because I can't tell. And what I was so pleased to find out from talking to all these other drummers was that Ringo has a very, very unique style. And it's only been the last maybe 3 or 4 years that he's starting to get some positive press about his drumming. You know, you got the Hall of Fame. You got all these amazing top drummers in the world all saying that Ringo was the guy. We wanted to drum like him. So I wanted to find out what made him different. Once I start talking to drummers and they explain it, then you think, yeah, it would not have been the same with any other drummer. Ringo really did contribute his fourth bit, and that's why we wanted to call the book Finding the Fourth Beatle. You know, the three of them, John, Paul and George, that was set in stone from the end of 1957. They were together in the group. But it was finding the guy who would stick at it, who'd be the right one. And Ringo was that guy. So I'm very proud to say we've gone at length to explain why Ringo is such a good drummer, why he was perfect for the Beatles, and why you couldn't take him out of the Beatles songs and replace him, because he contributed that much.
Yeah, one of the nice features in your book toward the end is where you pick a few songs that we know well and point out how great Ringo is on them. Not necessarily the ones that Ringo, you know, we associate, well, Yellow Submarine, that's Ringo, and Octopus's Garden is Ringo. And,
yeah.
But Ringo is Strawberry Fields Forever.
Oh, I love his drumming on that. Fantastic. I play air drums. That's as good as it gets.
I do that too.
Every time that song comes on, I just want to do those fills he puts in. They're absolutely brilliant.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Standing all you see. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Always know, sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
That was the Beatles featuring Ringo Starr on drums, and we're talking with David Bedford. He's the author of a fascinating history of the early Beatles called Finding the Fourth Beatle. Oh, we were just talking about listening to the Beatles and listening for the drums in their records.
It's such, and I say this to everybody, is do what I did, is go back and listen to the albums in chronological order and listen for the drumming. Very few people ever do that, unless the drummers. You know, you're listening for the guitars, you can hear the bass, you can hear the songs, you can hear the melody, the harmonies and everything. But go back listening to the drumming, and you suddenly hear things that you haven't noticed before. Then you think, that song would never be the same if it wasn't for Ringo's drumming.
Well, of course, one of the greatest things about the Beatles is that 50 years on, you can just keep listening and hear all kinds of things that you never heard before.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. And especially when they're digitally remastering everything, then you're picking up, you can hear, you know, the cymbals and everything so much clearer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Pete Best. You know, one of the things that I noticed about Pete Best a few years ago, I heard an interview with him, and I think it was the first extensive interview that I'd ever heard. And he struck me as a guy who, for whatever his talents as a drummer, he's not very funny or amusing the way Ringo is.
This is one of the problems when, particularly as a historian, I'm trying to write about a period between 1960 and 62, when we know what happened post-62. And it comes the same to when people are debating with me about the drumming. You say, you know, Ringo's a better drummer than Pete. You just listen to the drumming on Rain. And I said, yeah, that's fine for when that was recorded. But the only decision the Beatles were making was in 1962. You've got to put things in context. Ringo, for the first about 12 months, just before he came over to the US, Ringo was very, very shy, very quiet, hardly contributed to interviews, discussions, etc. Because he was finding his feet. He was quite quiet, and some people said he was a bit moody and miserable. But the best Ringo was coming over to America. Because over here, everybody knew he'd only just joined the group. That didn't matter when he came to the US. He could naturally be himself. That's when he fully integrated into the group, was in 64.
That's
so, yeah, he's got a different personality to Pete. But it depends. If you watch an interview with Pete, particularly the older ones, yeah, he was shy. But if you watch him now, when he's much more relaxed, and I tell you, having, you know, been in his company a number of times over the years, he is one very, very funny guy. We have some real good laughs. So he was like that back in 60 to 62, but there's no evidence to show you, apart from some anecdotes and then some, you know, some just post-exit little film clips and stuff. I mean, he's a very, very different character to Ringo, a very, very different drummer to Ringo as well. So I personally can't compare the two, because they are so, so different.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with David Bedford. He's the author of a book called Finding the Fourth Beatle, the untold story of the 23 drummers who put the beat in the Beatles. I think one of the great points you make in the book is that Ringo is the right drummer for that period and Pete for the period that he was drummer. So talk a little bit about those two periods and how they differ.
Yeah, I've been trying to work out for years, because sometimes for fun on Facebook, I'll just drop a bomb out there. I'll just mention something about Pete and Ringo, like the Blue Touch paper, and a step back, and people get so invested as to who their favourite is out of the two, and it's all kinds of rubbish gets spoken. I think, well, how can we do this to put it in context? So firstly, yeah, I enlisted various drummers to analyse both Pete's style and Ringo's. So we've got that. But I was trying to work out, because they're so different, what changed? And for me, what changed is when Pete left, he left a group which was the best rock and roll group anybody had seen. You know, you look at the interviews with John Lennon, he said, if you didn't see the Beatles in the ballrooms and the halls and the clubs in Liverpool and Hamburg in the black leathers, you never saw the real Beatles. That was their time with Pete. They developed this amazing sound, and it was that group that made them kings of Liverpool, Hamburg, got the attention of Brian Epstein, got the record deal, a Parlophone. But they had to make a big transition from rock and roll covers band to commercial recording pop group. And that's a different band. And they needed a different style. So, as you know from the book, I said, the only way I can reconcile it is they're two different bands. When Pete Best left, that was the end of the Beatles. When Ringo joined, that was the birth of the Fab Four, which is a pop group. And for me, they're two different bands. And so, you don't have to choose one over the other. You can say, Colin Hanson did a great job when he was with the Quarrymen. Pete Best did a brilliant job when he was with the Beatles up until 62. Then Ringo does a fantastic group with the Fab Four.
There are a lot of characters that show up in your story, and one of them is that's kind of sad is Jimmy Nicol. And I think anybody that had ever seen the Beatles anthology knows that at one point Ringo got sick and was replaced for just a few weeks by this guy. But it turned out not to be such a great thing for him.
It's weird. It's almost like it was the best thing that ever happened to him and the worst thing that ever happened to him. It's a funny thing. So it's the day before the Beatles are about to start their world tour in June 1964. Ringo gets taken ill, rushed to hospital, got to have his tonsils out. George Harrison says, well, if Ringo's not playing, I'm not playing. But nobody had done a world tour before. There was no such thing as tour insurance. You know, so many bookings had been made around the world. There's no way the tour could be cancelled. So at short notice, yet again, a drummer crisis. Word goes out, Jimmy Nicol is recommended. He comes along, does a little rehearsal with them. The following day, they're on the plane and off they go on the tour. Now, one of the good reasons for picking Jimmy was, in late 63, early 64, he was a very good session drummer. He was playing playing on some records called Top Six. And an entrepreneur thought, if the kids can't afford to buy the singles by the real artists, we'll get session musicians to do covers of them and put out six songs on a little EP. So Jimmy was in that group. And, of course, the group that was having all the hits at that time were the Beatles. So he covered so many of the Beatles' hit songs, didn't he? So he already knew them. So he was perfect. So off he goes, and they do their tours. You know, they're off in Denmark. They go to Amsterdam, then they go over to Hong Kong, and then they're down to Australia. So he's only with them for around 2 weeks. But of course, it was the biggest world tour any group had ever done. And then partway through the Australian leg of the tour, Ringo comes and joins up again. And there's film footage you can see. And at one point, you've got John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Jimmy Nichol all standing on a balcony. And Ringo's pretending to strangle Jimmy. And Jimmy's pretending to strangle Ringo. And you wonder from, did either of them think, if I just squeeze a little bit harder? That was it. Ringo was back. And there's this, the most sad photo ever. It's just a picture of Jimmy sat in the airport in Australia, in the departure lounge, on his own. Not a soul near him. A couple of days before, there were 300,000 people screaming for him. Now, how do you move on from that? And he couldn't. And he tried all kinds of stuff. He joined another band. He tried to get his own band going. He had limited success. He moved to Mexico, did stuff out there. And he just disappeared. Nobody knows where he is, unfortunately.
One, two, a one, two. What goes on?
Ringo Starr and the Beatles. We're talking with David Bedford. He's the author of Finding the Fourth Beatle, the untold story of 23 drummers who put the beat in the Beatles. How many of
the people that you were writing about have you gotten a chance to actually speak to and interview?
Very few, unfortunately. Colin Hanson I know really well. When I started working on Liddyfool, my first book, Colin only lives about 5 minutes from me. Literally, it's Penny Lane separates the two of us. We live either side of there. So I know him well. Johnny Hutch, I know Johnny really well. But a lot of them have passed on. Jackie Lomax I met once. But a lot of the other people, I mean, I've never got to meet any of the Fab Four. You know, so Ringo and Paul, that's all that's left now. Still haven't met them. Pete Best I know really well. Pete did the foreword to my first book, Liddyfool. Terry McCann, now there's another guy who played just a little bit longer than Jackie Lomax. He played for about 15 minutes in a little gig they were doing in Aldershot near London. and only 18 people were there. It was an absolute disaster. And Terry McCann got up behind the drums and he played for a little bit while the others danced. So I spoke to him, but he's since died. So a lot of them, sadly, have passed on. But it's been good just to track down their stories as much as possible. One interesting guy I spoke to a few years back was Andy White. And
oh, yeah.
He's the guy, of course, in September 62, George Martin said Pete Best drumming wasn't good enough. He's going to bring a session drummer in. Ringo goes down for the first session. George Martin says, I'm still going to bring a session drummer in. Ringo's not good enough. Andy White is the fellow who came in the next week. And so he drummed on Love Me Do and PS I Love You.
So when we listen to the Please, 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 Please Me album, yeah. which songs have Andy White on that, on the actual LP?
This is where, if you listen to Ringo, he gets it wrong. When the Beatles anthology came out, Ringo said, I was so disappointed. I didn't drum on the single, but at least I'm on the album. But it's the other way around. Ringo's version, the one which George Martin said wasn't good enough, actually came out on a single in the UK, possibly by mistake. When it came to the album, it was Andy White's version that you can hear. The B-side of the single, P.S. I Love You, that was Andy White's version as well. And the way you can tell the difference is that on the one with Andy White, what actually makes it even better is Ringo playing the tambourine. So if you listen to a version with a tambourine, that's Andy White playing drums and Ringo playing the tambourine.
Now, Andy White did not have that same... he didn't suffer like Jimmy Nicol. I mean, he was just happy to be a session drummer, and he went on to a career as a session drummer.
Yeah, he stayed a session drummer. You know, he was one of the busiest and most successful session drummers in Britain. He played on hundreds and hundreds of hit songs and albums. So he had a great career. Moved over to New Jersey. When I spoke to him, probably about 5 years ago now, he was still at the age of, he's in his early 80s, I think, still giving drum lessons in pipe bands. So he was still actively involved. Yep. But he's most famous for one morning's work, which would have earned him maybe £5. Then off he went to do another session. That was it.
What about the guy who claims that Ringo never played on any of the, and he did all the drumming?
Oh, the famous Bernard Purdy. It's one of the strangest stories ever. So Bernard Purdy, fantastic drummer. I mean, he has been one of the best drummers in the world. Played on all kinds. Brilliant. But he made this claim years ago that he was brought in to overdub Ringo's drumming on 21 Beatles songs. And his story went that Brian Epstein and George Martin brought the master tapes over to New York and asked him to cover up for Ringo songs. So he played them. He said, I can't remember them all, but one of them was definitely Yeah, Yeah, Yeah.
Oh, yeah, their big hit. Yeah, 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 Yeah.
Yeah, but he can't remember the song titles. And he made this remark a few times in a couple of books. Then he started saying, oh, I've had death threats, I can't say it anymore. And then, eventually, his autobiography came out. And I thought, I cannot wait to see what he's going to say. So I bought the autobiography, and once you read what he's actually written this time, what you can work out is the original first recordings the Beatles made with Tony Sheridan in Hamburg in 1961 was when Pete Best was playing drums. The producer, Bert Kanfert, didn't want a full drum set. He never used a full drum kit. So he said to Pete, just play your snare drum and your hi-hat. Once the Beatles became famous, they wanted to re-release them. But the drum sound, of course, was quite light. So actually what Bernard Purdy did was he filled out the drum sound over what Pete had done to make it sound a bit better, to re-release them as Beatles songs. That's a little bit different to overdubbing Ringo.
So when you hear Ain't She Sweet, that's Bernard Purdy?
Yeah, so when it's... Ain't She Sweet, and those by the Beatles and the release like that, Yeah, Bernard Purdy's playing on those. But you can still get the original recordings anyway, with Pete just playing his snare and his hi-hat. And again, that's one of those things that, thankfully, we have got those songs to listen to. And anybody who thinks Pete Best can't play drums, listen to My Bonnie. Listen to the drum rolls that he does and the speed that he does them at. That is, it's absolutely phenomenal drumming. Really is.
My Bonnie lies over the ocean. My Bonnie lies over the sea. Well, my Bonnie lies over the ocean. Yeah, bring back my Bonnie to me. Yeah, bring back, oh, bring back my Bonnie to me, I'll bring back, oh, bring back my Bonnie to me.
That was the Beatles with Pete Best on drums, recorded in Hamburg, Germany in 1961. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KFCO, and we're talking tonight with David Bedford. He's the author, along with Gary Popper, of a fascinating history of the Beatles called Finding the Fourth Beatle, the untold story of 23 drummers who put the beat in the Beatles. And we'll continue our conversation with David Bedford right after this.
Well, after Pete Best was ousted from the group, and I want to talk about that because it was kind of an underhanded thing, but did he ever speak to George, John, or Paul again, and has he since?
No, not a word. The group he joined, Lee Curtis and the All-Stars, they very, very quickly became one of the most popular groups in Liverpool. There's one or two occasions they were on the same bill as the Beatles, and they basically just walked past each other. Since then, not a word. And to be fair to Pete, he has said openly, you know, he would love to get together with Paul. He said because, you know, they're both granddads now. Forget all the rubbish stuff that went on. He said we had 2 years together, we had an absolute laugh. He said it'd be nice just to have a pint. Doesn't have to be in public, just private would be lovely. Because there's no hard feelings, but I don't think that's going to happen. So, no, he was never spoken to again, unfortunately.
That's kind of sad. You go into it in some detail in the book, but Pete Best really couldn't have been fired from the Beatles.
Yes. And this is something that ever since I started work on my first book, which is heading back almost 20 years now, the big question has always been, why was Pete Best sacked? And I tried to address it in my two earlier books. And I was just going through and thinking, there's so many rumours that are flying around everywhere. You know, it's, oh, he wouldn't get the haircut, he didn't smile, he didn't go out for a drink with them. And they were jealous of his good looks and all these things. I think there's got to be a real reason. Now, we always knew that George Martin had said to Brian Epstein, look, don't mind what you do with them as a group, but I'm going to bring in a session drummer. That's the only evidence we know for somebody criticising Pete's drumming. And it's clear that that led to him being replaced. Now, what's most likely is, after George Martin said that to Brian, who's a record retailer, no knowledge of the recording industry, he didn't understand that bringing in session musicians was quite a normal thing. So he says to John, Paul and George, look, George Martin doesn't think Pete's good enough to play on the record. And they think, well, it's the last chance for a record deal. We still don't know if we're going to get the deal or not. If we do, we're going to have to change Pete. So that's when they start. Okay, we've got to find another drummer. And so we knew that as fact. And then I tracked down Brian Epstein's lawyer, David Harris. Fascinating guy, still lives near me in Liverpool. And I went round to see him just to talk through the management contracts and stuff like that. And I knew he'd given Brian some advice about how to get rid of Pete. The stunning thing was, mid-conversation, he said, but of course, you do know that Pete couldn't be sacked. I said, hang on, say that again. Pete couldn't be sacked. I said, what do you mean? We've been told since 1962 he was sacked. I said, well, it's not possible. And this is what I said to Brian. The John Paul and George said to Brian, you've got to get rid of him. You're the manager, it's your job. And we just always assumed, because we've been told he was sacked, that that was the case, but he couldn't be. Because, first of all, Brian couldn't sack him. Because Brian didn't employ him. The Beatles employed Brian. So that deals with that bit. But obviously, to be sacked, you've got to be employed by somebody. And nobody employed Pete. So he couldn't be sacked. He couldn't be fired. There's anything like that. What we then realised when I spoke to the lawyer in depth and said, okay, explain to me why he couldn't be sacked. And he said, any group that's performing and working together, in the eyes of the law, is a partnership. One partner cannot sack another partner. If you want to get rid of them, you have to dissolve the partnership. Call an end to that company, draw up the accounts, have a share out, and then the others can go on and start a new partnership by getting somebody else in the group. The Beatles didn't do that. They didn't have time to do that. So they had to find a way to convince Pete he was being sacked without ever telling him he was. And that's basically what happened. When we go back and look at the words that both Pete and Brian have remembered from that meeting, Brian said to him, the boys want you out, i.e. your fellow partners want to get rid of you, and Ringo is joining Saturday, i.e. you're being replaced. Now, if Pete, instead of being a typical 21-year-old who knows nothing about the law, had been a law student, he would have said, that's very interesting, Brian. However, we're in a partnership. I'm going to go and consult my lawyer. It could have been very, very messy just when they're about to make the first record. But of course, Pete's a typical 21-year-old lad. You've been told you've been replaced. You think you've been sacked. And so they engineered a way to get him out of the group.
I'm sure hearing this later must have made him feel just great.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Pete is he got over it a long time ago. He's not bothered. He's not bothered in the least. He moved on by the late 60s. He couldn't care less about it anymore. And, you know, he still said, and I remember from the very first time I interviewed him, which was about 15 years ago, and he said to me, you know, I don't even bother anymore. I said, it doesn't worry me. I said, I've had a fantastic life. I've got a wonderful wife, a great family, lovely grandkids. I've got my health. What more could I want? I'm happy. And he genuinely is.
That's good to know. That was the Beatles with Pete Best on drums, and we're talking tonight with David Bedford. He's the author of Finding the Fourth Beatle, the untold story of 23 drummers who put the beat in the Beatles. You know, of course, I love the Beatles, and obviously, and I love John Lennon, you know, John Lennon, my idol. But John Lennon maybe wasn't such a nice guy. A lot of the people who were one of the 23 people in your book weren't crazy about John Lennon.
A very difficult person to get on with. We found that with the documentary feature film that I've just done, Looking for Lennon, which I think is now available on DVD over in the States, not out here yet. And we looked into tracing through what John's childhood was and through into his teens, etc. So he had a complicated upbringing. And often that showed itself in relationships, particularly within the group. So Tommy Moore, that I mentioned before, they did this little two-week tour in Scotland. And Tommy was a couple of years older than the others. But he's a very, very good drummer. And they were going to this little town called Fraserburgh. And they were driving in a van. And there was a crash with a car. The guitar cases, of course, all of that in the van with them, come flying forward. And they knock out some of Tommy's teeth. Split his lip, knock him out. So, of course, he ends up in hospital. He gets stitches in his lip, which is thick as anything. He's lost teeth. He's got concussion. But, of course, the group were playing that night. So John goes to the hospital bed and drags him out. And, of course, you know, if you've got a thumping headache, what's the one instrument you don't want to be playing?
Drums.
The drums, exactly. And so there's poor Tommy, sat behind his drum kit, thumping away. His head must have been banging. His lips flat with stitches in. And apparently what John would do is he'd turn around to try and make Tommy laugh so the stitches would split. What a lovely chap.
Nice guy.
So, of course, they come back to Liverpool and he's thinking, why am I putting up with this rubbish? And so that's why he quit. And so he was a difficult guy to get on with. And again, when it comes to replacing Pete Best, again, it wasn't just a case of, oh, we need to get Ringo in the band, we'll get rid of Pete. That wasn't the process. The process was, okay, we've got to replace Pete. Who are we going to ask? Well, there's three other drummers were approached. Bobby Graham was the first guy, who was a top session drummer. Was also playing in the top band, Joe Brown and the Brothers. But he turned Brian down. There's no way he was going to give all that up. A local guy called Richie Galvin, again, very, very good drummer. He wasn't particularly fond of John. He wouldn't have done it. Johnny Hutchinson, who was probably the best drummer in Liverpool. That's what all the musicians and promoters, everybody said. Fantastic drummer. He would not tolerate John Lennon for more than 5 minutes without punching him. That would never have happened. So John was a difficult guy to get along with. But when I've spoken to those, particularly when we were doing the documentary, would say, if you didn't get on with him, he would be horrible. I said, but if you were a friend of his, he would be loyal to the day he died. So he was a difficult character to get to know, but if you got on the right side of him, he could be a great, great guy. But yeah, he could be temperamental as well.
Well, the bottom line of your book is that even though it's focused on this one aspect of their history, it really is, it's not so much an in-depth biography, but it's an interesting history of, you know, like it's like a archaeologist's history of the early days of the Beatles. And it's called Finding the Fourth Beatle. And along with Gary Popper, the author, is my guest, David Bedford. David, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my absolute pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and it's been great fun talking to you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.